At the beginning of this podcast, we set out to answer some of the most important questions about the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. The idea is that if we zoom into each issue and review the arguments and evidence presented by both the Warren Report defenders and critics, we'll be in the best position to figure out what most likely happened for each question. And the hope is that the puzzle pieces of this mystery will come together at least enough for us to figure out which pieces to pick up next. In this Season 1 conclusion episode, we'll go over the list of tough positions that Warren Report defenders and critics alike are signing up to defend. Then, I'll share my conclusions for the 15 most important questions that we set out to answer in Episode 2. Finally, we'll talk about the plans for the future of this podcast.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
This is Solving JFK. I'm your host, Matt Crumpton. I want to take some time to point out that neither the Warren Report defender side nor the Warren Report critic side has a perfect argument here. No matter where you land, there are some implausible things that have to be true for you to be right. This case is by no means open and shut. It's hotly disputed for a reason, which is that the facts are very messy. Warren Report critics have to believe all or most of these things to have a theory that's consistent with the facts. You would have to believe that Oswald took the out-of-the-ordinary step of getting a ride with Buell Wesley Frazier on Thursday night for some reason other than because he needed to get his rifle, which was supposedly stored in the Payne garage. You'd believe that Frazier and his sister, Lenny Mae Randall, both lied or were mistaken about Oswald having a long paper bag and him saying that it had curtain rods in it. You'd say that the long paper bag that was found on the sixth floor, along with the three shells and the Mannlicher Carcano rifle matching the paperwork tied to the Hedel rifle order, must have either been fired by someone other than Oswald and left behind, or it must have been planted. You'd also have to believe that the rifle order had to be fabricated and the rifle itself was never received by Oswald. This would mean that Marina Oswald was lying about Lee owning the rifle and that the rifle order itself was placed to frame Oswald. It would also mean that either the FBI handwriting expert who said Oswald's writing was on the order coupon was lying or was wrong. It would mean that the evidence was manufactured by professional forgers, or that Oswald did place the order in his handwriting, but that he didn't actually receive the rifle. You'd believe that Oswald's fingerprints on the paper sack would have to be either planted by law enforcement or legitimately obtained when he was touching the paper for reasons related to his job, but it was then used to frame him. You'd have to take the controversial position that Lieutenant Day planted the palm print evidence and then sent it to the FBI belatedly on an index card. You'd also say that the bullet from the first shot that came from the grassy knoll and hit Kennedy's throat must have been lost in Kennedy's body and not found, or intentionally obscured at the autopsy because it's not accounted for. You'd have to believe that someone could shoot the president in the daytime while simply hiding behind a fence and only be seen clearly by Ed Hoffman and be noticed tangentially by Lee Bowers. You'd probably say that the person posing as a Secret Service agent is the most likely Grassy Knoll assassin, that the dark-complected man with the walkie-talkie giving hand signals is probably involved too, and Stephen Louis Witt may not be telling the truth about knowing this man. The Secret Service assassin would then also have had to escape along with the person that he was with, according to Hoffman and Bowers. If you think Oswald is not guilty of killing anyone, as he says, you'd have to believe that Officer Tippett was murdered by someone who resembled Oswald, but had a ruddy complexion. You'd likely also believe that this same individual was impersonating Oswald in other instances. You'd also believe that Oswald would have to get a ride from his rooming house to the Texas Theater to be consistent with Butch Burroughs' timeline. You'd argue that Oswald's revolver, which he says he bought in Fort Worth, not through the mail, must have been swapped out by the Dallas police or the FBI with the revolver that had the same serial number associated with the Hiddell revolver in evidence. You'd also have to believe the extremely hard-to-swallow position that the autopsy and its corresponding photographs and x-rays were materially altered, or that there were two separate sets of photos and x-rays that were created, and that Doctors Humes, Boswell, and Fink were all knowingly complicit in the cover-up. Finally, you'd believe that Jack Ruby is not crazy and take him at his word, even though there's evidence from his psychiatrist that he was mentally insane. On the Warren Report defender side, it's no walk in the park either. You're signing up for these positions based on the record. You would say that it's not a problem that the only witness putting Oswald in the window with a gun didn't identify him in a lineup on the day of the assassination, and that no one saw Oswald coming down from the sixth floor. It's also not an issue that the key witness who claims to see Oswald with the package which allegedly had the gun, Buell Wesley Frazier, says that the paper sack in evidence is longer and different from the one that he saw. Also, it's not a problem that no witnesses in the building saw Oswald carrying a paper sack or a gun. You'd believe that Oswald left work at Jagger's Child's Stovall on March 12, 1963 at 10:30 a.m. to mail the rifle order coupon and payment, even though his time cards show that he was working all morning. You also must believe that there was an error that caused Oswald's money order to never be deposited, since there's no bank endorsement on the money order. Somehow, the deposit document says that it was deposited a month before Oswald sent the payment. You also would have to believe that dozens of witnesses are wrong or lying. As a small sampling, you would have to believe all these people are wrong or lying. The 43 witnesses who said that there was a right rear wound in the back of Kennedy's head. Arnold Rowland, Carolyn Arnold, Richard Randolph Carr, Carolyn Walther, Victoria Adams, Sandra Stiles, Vicki Garner, Amos Ewens, Deputy Sheriff Roger Craig, Marvin Robinson, Roy Cooper, Helen Forrest, James Pennington, Ed Hoffman, Gordon Arnold, Lee Bowers, Officer Joe Smith, Deputy Constable Seymour Weitzman, FBI agents Vincent Drain, Bardwell Odom, Francis O'Neill, and James Seibert, Dennis David, Paul O'Connor, Joe O'Donnell, Tom Robinson, Daryl Tomlinson, and O.P. Wright. When the majority of Dealey Plaza witnesses say that the pattern of the shots was boom, 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 you would have to believe that there are at least 1.7 seconds between the two booms in close succession at the end. You'd also have to accept the official autopsy records over all medical records from Parkland Hospital, which means that the eight Parkland doctors who said that they saw destroyed cerebellar tissue were wrong, even though one of them was the chief of neurosurgery. You would also ignore what photographer John Stringer said about the brain that he photographed having severe damage to the cerebellum. You would have to choose which head entry wound you believe is most likely, the lower Warren Report position or the higher Clark Panel HSCA position. You have to not be suspicious about Kennedy's personal doctor, George Berkeley, contacting the HSCA to testify about his knowledge of a conspiracy and then changing his mind. You have to ignore all evidence of a lower rear back wound, including clothing, photographs, witness statements, autopsy facing sheets, and the Seibert O'Neill report. You'd also disregard the video of Press Secretary Malcolm Kilduff pointing to his temple and saying it was, quote, a simple matter of a bullet straight through the head. You'd put aside that at least seven Parkland doctors said that Kennedy's throat wound was an entrance wound. You would have to ignore the comparisons of the bullets from the shooting tests and the almost pristine nature of CE-399 and write the anomaly off to different bullet velocities in the shooting tests based on how far away the gun was shot in those tests versus where Oswald allegedly was when he shot from the sniper's nest. You would have to believe that Oswald was as good of a shooter as some of the best shooters in the world, even though testimony from his military peers and his last shooting test shows otherwise. And there's no evidence of Oswald practicing at all before the assassination. You would have to assume that everyone's watches were materially off when it comes to the timeline of the Tippit murder. And you'd also assume that Aquila Clemens and Frank Wright must have been lying or mistaken about what they saw, and that Warren Reynolds being shot in the head is just a coincidence and his perception that it was tied to the assassination was wrong. You would have to disregard any evidence that implies that there was an intentional Oswald lookalike, including the man running out of the back of the school book depository building, getting into a Nash Rambler in Dealey Plaza, the Ralph Yates FBI report, the Dobbs House FBI report, the Texas Theater rear exit, the shooting range stories from Dr. Homer Wood and his son Sterling Wood, and mechanic T.F. White seeing someone in a parked car who looked identical to Oswald after we know that Oswald was already in custody. And you'd have to think that it's a mere coincidence that the license plate of this car is then traced to a military contractor who was close friends with Tippit. You would also have to believe that Ruby was simply setting up a wire transfer next to the police station at the time when Oswald was being moved because he wanted to help his employee who was getting paid the next day anyway. And you'd have to ignore what Jack Ruby said about his own motive and the legal defense he made regarding his motive, under the logic that Ruby's crazy and he shouldn't be believed. In the interest of not being repetitive, I'm going to be as brief as possible in summarizing my conclusions for each of these issues. That means that important information may be left out. If you hear anything that doesn't make sense, I encourage you to go back to the episode where we discussed the topic at length for more context, or visit the sources and transcripts at solvingjfkpodcast.com. Issue number one from episodes 3 and 4. Was Oswald in place on the 6th floor when the shots were fired? No, I don't think so. The official story here relies heavily on Howard Brennan's identification of Oswald in the window, the fact of Oswald's fingerprints on some of the boxes in the sniper's nest, and, most importantly, the fact that the Mannlicher Carcano that was found on the 6th floor was tied to a P.O. box associated with Oswald's alias, A.J. Hedell. But critics point out that Brennan didn't identify Oswald on the night of the assassination, and no one saw Oswald walking up to the sixth floor immediately before or walking down from the sixth floor immediately after the shots were fired. Oswald looked calm and collected when Officer Baker and building supervisor Roy Truly encountered him on the second floor. To me, it does not look like Oswald was on the sixth floor when the shots were fired. I rely on statements from Victoria Adams and Sandra Stiles that they came down the same set of stairs that Oswald would have had to use at the same time he should have been on them, and they did not see him or hear anything on the stairs. They left to go downstairs before the president's car drove under the railroad overpass, which, again, should put them in that stairwell at the same time as Oswald. Also, their boss, Dorothy Garner, said that Officer Baker came upstairs after Adams and Stiles had gone downstairs. Since Oswald was on the second floor already when he encountered Baker and Truly, and there was only one set of stairs, this means that Oswald could not have been on the sixth floor. On top of that, Carolyn Arnold says that she saw Oswald on the second floor at 12:25. Arnold Rowland says that he saw a light-skinned man with dark hair with a rifle in the window at 12:15, and that the man was accompanied by an older bald man with dark skin. Carolyn Walther also claimed to see two men in high-up windows. The open question here is, if Rowland and Walther saw two men, one of whom was a practically bald, dark-skinned man, who were these men, and how did they get out of the building? Solving JFK is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Fiscally responsible, financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Because Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help you when you need it, so your dollar goes a long way. Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations. You've heard me talk about the online cannabis company that's revolutionizing how we deal with life's challenges, from sleepless nights to stress-filled days. I'm talking about Mood.com, which has created an entire line of functional gummies and flower crafted for your ideal mood, made with 100% federally legal THC. Not only that, but they'll deliver them directly to your doorstep so you can have your own clandestine herbal journey. You can get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with promo code JFK. What makes Mood.com's gummies different is how they've paired THC and other cannabinoids with herbs and adaptogens. You're just not going to find gummies like this in a dispensary, or anywhere for that matter. But their flower is what really blows me away. They partner with small, family-owned American farms who are custom cultivating their bud with unique terpene profiles. So you can choose a strain to help you feel more social, chilled out, or even more focused and productive. Best of all, not only does Mood.com stand behind everything with an industry-leading 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned, you can get 20% off your first order with code JFK. So head to Mood.com and browse their amazing selection of functional gummies and flower and find the perfect one for whatever you're dealing with. Remember, use promo code JFK at checkout to save 20% off your first order. Issue number 2 from episode 5. Did Oswald bring the rifle into the school book depository building in a paper sack under the guise of curtain rods? I'm not sure about Oswald bringing the rifle, but I don't believe these mysterious curtain rods ever existed. Frazier gave Oswald a ride to work on the morning of the assassination. This is not disputed. But Frazier's story about what Oswald had in his hands that morning is intensely debated. Oswald, for what it's worth, said that it was a regular paper bag with his lunch. Warren Report defenders believe that Oswald did bring the rifle into the school book depository in a long paper sack, which Frazier's sister, Lenny Mae Randall, also says that she saw Oswald holding as he got into Frazier's car. Critics point to the length of the disassembled rifle and how it would have been impossible for Oswald to carry it the way that Frazier describes him carrying it, with the bottom of the bag cupped in his hand and the top under its armpit. That wouldn't be possible due to the length of the disassembled rifle. Also, the package that was found was much longer than what Frazier described and was a different type of package. For me, I rate this issue as inconclusive. The whole thing really comes down to, do you believe Frazier and his sister? I have no knowledge of why they would lie, unless someone put them up to it, which we have no evidence for. But a few things caused me to question Frazier's story about the curtain rods. Edward Shields says that he saw Frazier in the parking lot on the morning of the assassination, and Frazier was alone, which undermines Frazier's story about walking in together with Oswald. There's also Frazier's mysterious midnight polygraph at the police station, which has no records, but which Frazier supposedly passed. And Frazier recently brought up a new story about seeing a man with a fancy hat and a gun in the parking lot for the first time when his book was recently released. His claim is something that no one else associated with the case has ever made. The open question here is, if Oswald didn't bring in the Carcano, then who did? And how did the one that was found make its way to the sixth floor? Issue number 3 from episode 5. Do Oswald's fingerprints on the boxes in the sniper's nest and on the paper sack prove that he fired the shots? My answer is not really. Oswald's left palm print and right index fingerprints were found on the top box of the stacked boxes in the sniper's nest. Oswald also had a right palm print on another nearby box. The obvious Warren Report critic answer is that Oswald worked on the sixth floor and he would have come into contact with those boxes as part of his job. Now, whether he actually did or not, we don't know. A 38-inch long paper sack, which is about a foot longer than Frazier and his sister said, was also found in the sniper's nest on the sixth floor. That sack had Oswald's right palm print and also his left index fingerprint. It was made from materials that were taken from the depository, according to the Warren Report. The official story is that this paper bag is the same one that Frazier and Randall saw. The gun fits inside of it, and it has Oswald's fingerprints on it. This seems to implicate Oswald and confirm Frazier's story about the paper sack. But critics point to a few inconsistencies with this paper bag. First, Oswald never got any paper or tape from Troy West, the man who was responsible for dispensing paper and tape at the depository. And Oswald was never seen with this paper sack or the materials to make it by anyone. There were no creases inside of the paper bag, and there were no markings from grease or cosmoline that the rifle was coated in when it was shipped. It also doesn't seem to make sense that Oswald didn't get any other prints on the bag aside from a palm print and an index fingerprint if he made the bag himself and carried it the way that Frazier says he did. Most importantly, Frazier insisted during his Warren Commission testimony that the length of the paper sack in evidence was much longer than the one he saw Oswald with. But he also says that he didn't look that closely. These issues are inconclusive to me. Oswald's prints on the boxes can't be relied on because he would have had a legitimate reason to have fingerprints on the boxes when he picked them up for his job. But based on what we know Oswald said, which is that he didn't know anything about curtain rods and that he brought his lunch that day, the record seems to indicate that either Frazier is wrong about the length of the package and Oswald did have the disassembled rifle in the long sack in evidence today, or Frazier wasn't telling the truth and Oswald did have his lunch. There's no evidence of any curtain rods ever existing that could have been transported on November 22nd by Oswald. He already had curtain rods at his rooming house. And we have to remember that the Ralph Yates Oswald lookalike hitchhiker story demonstrates likely foreknowledge by this Oswald imposter of a curtain rods cover story. That is, unless Ralph Yates made this whole story up. Now, I don't think that's the case because we have FBI reports that tell us that Yates told his co-worker, Dempsey Jones, about the interaction before the assassination, which Jones verified to the FBI. And then Yates passed 4 lie detector tests, the last one personally ordered by J. Edgar Hoover. Ultimately, this led to Yates being involuntarily detained in a mental institution. So no, I don't believe the curtain rods ever existed. Issue 4 from Episode 7. Did Oswald order the Mannlicher Carcano rifle in evidence? I'm not sure, but there is a good possibility that evidence was manufactured to make it look like Oswald did. Oswald admitted that he owned the P.O. box where the Carcano rifle was sent, though he denied ordering the rifle, and he didn't say anything about whose name the P.O. box was under. FBI handwriting experts said that Oswald's writing matched the writing on the order coupon, and the serial number of the rifle that was found on the 6th floor matched the one in the paperwork that the Warren Report says Oswald ordered. For Warren Report defenders, this is one of the strongest pieces of evidence that conclusively convicts Oswald. But critics point to discrepancies in the record to undermine this evidence of Oswald ordering the rifle. First, the February 1963 magazine ad, which is the one that Oswald would have used based on the coupon, shows a 36-inch rifle for sale. But the one that's found on the 6th floor is a 40-inch rifle. It is strange that the company sent a different length rifle than the one that was requested on the coupon. Next, the payment for the rifle was sent on March 12th from Dallas and arrived in Chicago the next day on March 13th. It was then supposedly opened, processed, and deposited all on the same day. This seems rather unlikely, especially the idea that the payment could arrive by the next day in 1963. Presumably, if it did arrive next day, it would have been too late in the day for clients to process the payment internally and then go make the deposit with the bank. And finally, the bank slip from Klein's deposit of this payment is dated February 15th, but the order again was sent on March 12th, so that date cannot be correct. And when we consider that Oswald's mail was being monitored, as demonstrated by the FBI's knowledge of his statements in his outgoing mail, the possibility that someone else ordered and received the rifle for Oswald has to be considered. The problem with that is the FBI handwriting expert says that Oswald's writing is on that order coupon. Now, despite this purported handwriting match, I've recently come across more evidence that potentially shows that Oswald did not order the rifle. The Hedell money order was postmarked at 10:30 a.m. on March 12th, which means that Oswald would have presumably walked to the nearby downtown post office to send it. But Oswald's time cards at his job at the time, which was at Jagger's Child's Stovall, show that he worked and did not leave the building from 8 a.m. until 12:15 that day. So he couldn't have been at the post office at 10:30. The envelope that this money order was in was stamped as being sent from Zone 12, which was several miles west of the downtown post office and where Oswald worked at the time. That doesn't line up with Oswald sending it at 10:30 a.m. on March 12th. Also, there are no bank endorsement stamps on the back of the money order. This suggests that the money order itself was never actually deposited by Kleins into any bank account. So the possibilities here are that Oswald either ordered the Carcano, as the Warren Report says, and there are lots of bizarre anomalies, as we just said, or the FBI clumsily fabricated a paper trail. The reason I can't conclude that Oswald did not order the Carcano is that we still have this handwriting match. Although, if the FBI would fabricate evidence, is it so hard to believe that they would fabricate a handwriting match or be good enough at forgery that they could fool their own in-house handwriting expert? Maybe. Issue number 5 from episode 8. Was Oswald's palm print found on the barrel of the Carcano? I'm not sure. According to Lieutenant Day of the Dallas Police Department, there was fingerprint evidence found near the metal housing near the trigger and also a lifted palm print from the underside of the barrel. The prints near the metal housing were of no value, according to the FBI fingerprint expert Sebastian Latona. Latona didn't notice any lifted print or any other prints. Then 6 days after Latona first got the rifle, he received a lifted palm print on an index card with a note from Lieutenant Day. And the note said it was from the underside gun barrel of the rifle in evidence. This late arriving lifted palm print matched Lee Harvey Oswald's right palm. This is the only fingerprint evidence that exists to tie Oswald to the murder weapon. Warren Report defenders point to an FBI memo on September 11, 1964, that says that lab examiners were able to link the lifted palm print to the underside of the gun barrel based on inconsistencies in the metal, even though FBI expert Latona did not initially see any evidence of any lifted prints. Critics counter by pointing out the absurdity that such an important piece of evidence would arrive days later on an index card. Also, Lieutenant Day wrapped the trigger guard in cellophane because he knew there was evidence there. Why would he not wrap the underbarrel in cellophane to protect it also if he knew there was evidence there? Even if he did lift the palm print, you would think he would want to preserve that evidence. The FBI agent who picked up the rifle from Lieutenant Day, Vincent Drain, claims that Day did not mention anything about the lifted print on the underside of the barrel, but Lieutenant Day insists that he did tell Drain about the lifted print. So this question is inconclusive for me. I'm not ready to just throw out everything that every FBI expert says. But you do have to admit that a late arriving lifted palm print from an area of the rifle not wrapped in cellophane that is disputed by the FBI agent who picked it up isn't exactly the most persuasive evidence against Oswald. Issue number 6 from episode 8. Do the paraffin tests incriminate Oswald? The quick answer is that it doesn't matter a ton because the Warren Report itself says that the paraffin tests given to Oswald were completely unreliable. Oswald tested positive for nitrates on both hands and negative for nitrates on his cheek, which would be close to the weapon at the time of shooting if the shooter was carefully aiming. There are competing experts on the issue of whether Carcano Ammo would be expected to release nitrates such that they would show up on Oswald's face. Warren Report defenders say that the nitrates on his hands show that Oswald recently fired a weapon. But critics counter that Oswald was also seen reading a newspaper, which would have put nitrates on his hands. And the paraffin casts show nitrates on Oswald's palm and fingers, not on the back of his hands, where you would expect it to fall if he was holding the rifle. Also, regarding whether we should expect to find nitrates on Oswald's cheek, it looks like the person who administered the test thought that they would be there. Otherwise, they wouldn't have bothered doing the paraffin process on a place where they wouldn't expect to find results. I rate this issue as inconclusive and agree with the Warren Report that the paraffin tests are unreliable. Issue 7 from Episode 20. Could Oswald have fired the shots that he's accused of firing under the same circumstances? My view is that an expert probably could have made those shots, but not Oswald. The sniper's nest was on the sixth floor. It would be easy for anyone to make one shot because it's not very far away. But the fact that the vehicle was moving and a bolt-action rifle was used, combined with the Zapruder film serving as a timer for how long the shots lasted, it would have been very difficult, but not impossible, to make the shots Oswald is accused of making. Now, the Warren Report and CBS both used some of the best shooters in the world for their tests, and they had minimal success. But so long as the second two shots that everyone says were in close succession were not closer than 1.7 seconds, it is possible that an expert could have made those shots. But the weight of the evidence is that Oswald could not likely have made the shots. I base this partially on his extremely poor score on his last Marine shooting test in 1959, the fact that his other shooting test was better but not great, and also the testimony of his peers in the Marines who say that Oswald was not a good shooter. Most of all, there's no evidence in the record that Oswald had any practice at all with the rifle before the assassination. And with a bolt-action rifle that has a defective scope, he would need all the practice he could get. Issue number 8 from episodes 9 through 12. What are the indisputable facts from Dealey Plaza? Let's talk about what we know happened within Dealey Plaza based on episodes 9 through 12. These things are not disputed. At a minimum, there were 3 shots fired overall. At least one shot, and as many as 3, were fired from the Texas School Book Depository building. Most of the witnesses recall the second and third shots being bunched close together, and when we zoom into the witness testimony, we see that 44 people are on the record saying that the last two shots came in quick succession. Now, let's look at the disputed issues. Issue number 9. What are the disputed questions from the Dealey Plaza witnesses? The first question is, did anyone see shots fired from the grassy knoll? The answer is yes, according to at least 2 and as many as 6 witnesses, they saw a shot come from the grassy knoll. There's a lot of different testimony about what direction the shots came from. Many of the witnesses tried to identify where the shots came from based on what they heard, which is not very reliable since we know that Dealey Plaza has a severe echo. There are 4 railroad employees who stood on the overpass: S.M. Holland, Richard Dodd, James Simmons, and Austin Miller all saw a puff of smoke come from behind the fence on the top of the grassy knoll. This puff of smoke was likely the smoke and fire that resulted from the shot being fired itself. not a puff of smoke that lingered in the air for a long time. But these four men all saw this puff of smoke and then ran to the location where they saw it coming from immediately after so they could see if they could find the shooter. Their actions corroborate their testimony and persuade me that they truly believed that shots had been fired from behind the fence on the grassy knoll. We also have testimony from Lee Bowers, who was working in the railroad tower and had a bird's eye view of the parking lot and the back of the fence, which was about 150 yards away from the tower. Bowers said he saw two men near the fence, and he also saw a flash of light or smoke or something at the time of the shooting. Finally, there's controversial witness Ed Hoffman, the deaf-mute man who claims to have seen the grassy knoll shooter from the highway about 200 yards away. Hoffman said that he saw two men, one heavier man in a dark suit and dark hat, and another man who was tall, thin, and dressed like a railroad worker. Hoffman says that the man in the dark suit was standing behind the fence and then reached down for something, then lifted it up, and he saw a puff of smoke. Then, Hoffman says that he saw the man turn with a long gun and toss the gun to the railroad worker, who twisted it to disassemble it, and then put it in a brown tool bag and ran down the railroad tracks. The FBI documents do not support Hoffman's story. They show that he spoke to police and that he spoke to the FBI, but according to these records, Hoffman was telling the FBI that he was mistaken and he actually didn't see anything. Now, Hoffman claims that the FBI misrepresented what he told them. Ed Hoffman's story is potentially supported by statements from Officer Tom Tilson and from J.C. Price, both of whom said they saw a man running down the train tracks behind the fence immediately after the shots were fired. Also, Officer Joe Smith, who was the first one at the top of the grassy knoll after the shots were fired, said that he smelled gunpowder right away. The next disputed Dealey Plaza issue is, was there someone impersonating Secret Service near the grassy knoll? The answer is yes. That's what the evidence indicates. Officer Joe Smith and Deputy Constable Seymour Weitzman both told the Warren Commission that they saw a man near the stockade fence, which is at the top of the grassy knoll, who displayed Secret Service credentials. Gordon Arnold, whether he's credible or not, also echoed this story. The problem is that all Secret Service agents remained with the motorcade, according to the Warren report. This means that the person who showed the Secret Service ID was impersonating Secret Service, or it means that Smith, Weitzman, and Arnold were all mistaken. Now, I can buy Gordon Arnold not telling the truth or being wrong, although I think it is possible that he was telling the truth. But I don't see how Officer Smith or Deputy Constable Weitzman could both be wrong about such a specific claim. They have no reason to lie, and their stories remained consistent. Now, this is a disturbing conclusion to reach because it means that whoever was impersonating Secret Service could have been involved with firing a shot from the grassy knoll, or at least would have been in a position to see who did. Why else would there be someone with a fake Secret Service credential in the exact place where critics suspect the second shooter fired? Next, did anyone see the grassy knoll shooter? The closest we have to anyone actually seeing the shooter is the combined story of Lee Bowers and Ed Hoffman. Bowers is not specific enough, and Hoffman is highly disputed as being not credible. Finally, is there anything suspicious about the umbrella man or the dark-complected man who sat near him on the curb? The Zapruder film shows a man flapping an umbrella right at the moment when the shots are fired at President Kennedy. Now, a lot of people believe the umbrella was used as a signal from a spotter for whether the president had been hit or not. This mystery man flapping the umbrella came to be known as the Umbrella Man in JFK assassination lore. But during the HSCA hearings, Stephen Louis Witt came forward and said that he was the Umbrella Man and that the purpose of him flapping the umbrella was actually to protest the appeasement policies of Kennedy's father, Joseph Kennedy, during World War II. Now, aside from Witt's testimony about him being the Umbrella Man, and the fact that Witt brought what he claimed was the same umbrella with him to the HSCA hearing, we have no proof that Witt was actually the Umbrella Man. The video and photo evidence is too grainy to tell. I could accept Witt's story, but for one major issue. It doesn't explain the actions of the dark-complected man who was seen sitting next to the Umbrella Man on the curb after the assassination. The identity of this man has never been uncovered. And like the Umbrella Man, this man appeared to be signaling at the time of the shots. You can see him raising a closed fist right when Kennedy passes him in the Zapruder film. Witt says that he didn't know the man and that this man was mumbling, "They done shot them folks," as he sat next to him on the curb. But I don't understand how these two men were sitting on the curb in Dealey Plaza like they were kids waiting to be picked up from soccer practice when everyone else was reacting by ducking or running behind the fence up the grassy knoll. Oh, and the dark-complected man appears to have a walkie-talkie which he puts up to his face and then tucks into the back of his pants and he walks away. The identity of this man needs to be uncovered so that we can rule out anything nefarious. Until it is, both the Umbrella Man and the dark-complected man remain persons of interest in this case. Issue number 10, from episodes 13 through 15. Is it possible that CE-399, the bullet in the National Archives today, is the single bullet that hit both Kennedy and Connolly? The answer is no, it is not possible due to chain of custody issues, the condition of the bullet, and timing issues. First, let's talk about the chain of custody. Now, according to the Warren Report, this bullet, CE-399, was found by Daryl Tomlinson on a stretcher outside the elevators on the ground floor of Parkland Hospital. Tomlinson gave it to the head of security, O.P. Wright, who gave it to Secret Service agent Richard Johnson, who gave it to Secret Service chief James Rowley, who gave it to FBI agent Elmer Todd, who then gave it to Robert Frazier at the FBI crime lab. So six people had possession of this bullet at one time. But when we zoom in to the evidence, only two of them, FBI agents Todd and Frazier, confirmed that CE-399 was the same bullet that they once had in their possession. Tomlinson, Wright, Johnson, and Rowley all could not identify it and said CE-399 did not look like the bullet they handled. Now, there's a dispute about whether Tomlinson and Wright actually did positively identify the bullet. This is because CE-2011, which is an FBI summary document about the chain of custody for CE-399, does say that Tomlinson and Wright identified the bullet. But Wright and Tomlinson told author Josiah Thompson that they did not recognize CE-399 as the one that they once possessed. This then led to Thompson's colleague, Dr. Gary Aguilar, contacting FBI agent Bardwell Odom, who was the agent that the FBI says showed Wright and Tomlinson the bullet. But Odom said that he never possessed CE-399, and he never met with Tomlinson and Wright at Parkland Hospital. He also said that there would be documentation of the meeting if it ever happened, and there's no documentation that shows Odom met with Tomlinson or Wright to show them CE-399. So it appears that CE-2011, this FBI summary document, may be a fraudulent document based on the lack of any underlying FBI reports to support it. The next issue with CE-399 is its condition. Now, people say it's a pristine bullet, and it is in very good condition for a bullet that went through what the Warren Report says it went through. But the bottom of this bullet is slightly dented. And there's also a small piece that's been taken out of the nose, which it turns out was removed by the FBI lab so that they could do analysis on it. HSCA Exhibit F-294 is an image that shows four bullets side by side. Two basically pristine bullets that were shot into bales of cotton, one bullet that's dented in the middle, which hit a goat rib, and one bullet that's completely smashed that hit a human cadaver wrist. When compared to CE-399, it's indisputable that the bullets that most closely resemble it are the two that were shot into bales of cotton. Now, the counterargument to believing your eyes is that the test bullets were fired from closer and thus had higher velocity. That may be true, but it by no means proves that a bullet could go through one man's body and then hit another man's rib, shatter a wrist bone, come out the forearm, and embed into a leg, and still be in as good of a condition as CE-399. Now, Governor Connally had the pieces of the bullet, the fragments that went through his wrist, removed. Given that CE-399 is supposed to be the bullet that left those fragments, we would think that the fragments from Connally's wrist would match up to the bullet. But there are no places on the bullet that are missing any material large enough that the fragments could fit. In other words, the puzzle pieces simply don't line up. Finally, Dr. Robert Shaw said that the bullet was still in Connally's thigh prior to the surgery being done on his thigh. Medical records show that this thigh surgery was from 4 o'clock to 4:20, but the bullet was found on the stretcher around 1 p.m. So I conclude that CE-399 could not possibly be the bullet that went through Kennedy and Connally, as the Warren Report alleges.
Chronological age is your birthday. Biological age is how old your body really is, and it's the strongest predictor of disease risk and mortality. True Diagnostic gives you your biological age and health markers, plus a simple personalized 90-day plan after analyzing over a million data points. Their True Age test measures longevity and aging and includes Symphony Age, tracking the health of 11 organ systems, like your heart, brain, lungs, immune system, and more. The test also gives you the top three things that you can do right now to slow down or reverse the aging process for you specifically. You can order online, and the kit ships right to your door. It's just a quick, simple finger prick at home, and then you drop it in the prepaid return package. Your only job is to follow the three recommendations for 90 days, and then you can retest to check your progress. True Diagnostic offers a one-time kit, or you can get a subscription of 4 tests every 90 days. So check out True Diagnostic. They use advanced epigenetic testing to analyze over a million biomarkers, and they help you identify the three most important things you can do over the next 3 months to make your health better. They're trusted by top longevity clinics and health professionals, not just consumers at home. Right now, Solving JFK listeners can get 20% off at truediagnostic.com using code JFK20 at checkout. That's truediagnostic.com and use code JFK20 for 20% off today.
Issue number 11 from episodes 13 through 15. Regardless of whether CE-399 is the bullet, is the single bullet theory possible? I believe the answer is no. The evidence does not support the possibility of the single bullet theory. President Kennedy had a throat wound, which was obscured by the tracheotomy that was performed over it at Parkland Hospital. He also had an upper back or back of the neck wound, whose location is intensely disputed. The possibility of the single bullet theory depends largely on the details of these wounds. Most of the Parkland doctor's initial impressions were that the throat wound was an entry wound, including Dr. Perry, the surgeon who performed the tracheotomy over the wound, and Drs. Aiken, Baxter, Carrico, Clark, Crenshaw, Jones, McClelland, and Peters. The testimony of these Parkland doctors is the best evidence that we have about how the throat wound initially looked, because there's no other documentation of it, and the autopsy doctors didn't dissect the wound. So the weight of the only medical evidence that we have about this throat wound points to it being an entrance wound. But if it was an entrance wound, then there's no exit for it, which is problematic if you're a Warren Report critic. The other relevant wound on Kennedy is his back of the neck or upper back wound. The location is crucial because if it was too low to have exited from Kennedy's throat on the same trajectory as when it hit Kennedy's body coming down from the sixth floor, then the single bullet theory cannot be true. The report that was written by FBI agents Seibert and O'Neill, which documented what the autopsy doctors in Bethesda said and did, says that the back wound was of a short depth with no point of exit. Now, the counterargument is that rigor mortis would have set in, so it would have been hard to get a probe through the muscles if the bullet went through. But Seibert and O'Neill were just writing down what the doctor said, which was no point of exit. There's no mention by the doctors of rigor mortis, and one would think that these three doctors would be aware of that concept. There are other reasons to believe that this rear wound was lower and more to the right than the Warren report says. The Seibert and O'Neill report also says that the wound was below the shoulders and 2 inches to the right of the middle line of the spinal column. 5 Secret Service agents are on record saying that this wound was between the shoulder and the neck or in the soft part of the shoulder. The autopsy facing sheet itself shows the wound being in the upper back and to the right. The death certificate itself, written by Kennedy's personal physician, Dr. Berkeley, puts the wound at the 3rd thoracic vertebra, which is materially lower than where the Warren report claims it is. The holes in Kennedy's clothing are also consistent with this lower and more to the right position. Probably the most compelling piece of evidence is the autopsy photo that's been leaked and shows this wound. When we look at the photo, it's exactly in the place where it's described to be by everyone I just cited, the upper back between his spine and shoulder blade. This is obvious to me, even though Kennedy is on his side in the picture and his head is turned up so that it looks like there's less space between the bottom of his head and his back. But look, don't take my word for it. Here's what Chief Counsel on the Warren Commission, J. Lee Rankin, said in a closed-door meeting on January 27, 1964. Quote, "We have a picture of where the bullet entered in the back, that the bullet entered below the shoulder blade to the right of the backbone, which is below the place the picture shows the bullet came out in the neckband of the shirt in the front." The evidence conclusively establishes that the entrance wound in Kennedy's back is too low and too much to the right to have possibly exited from Kennedy's throat. And remember, the trajectory of the wounds must match the trajectory of the shots coming down from the sixth floor. This means that the entrance wound in Kennedy's back would have to be noticeably higher than any alleged exit wound in his throat. And that's not the case. Also, while it's not something that I base my conclusions on, We have the left-to-right zigzagging nature of the single bullet that resulted in it getting this magic bullet nickname. It's possible that Connally and Kennedy could have been in alignment for a split second, such that the bullet could have gone through, assuming that the entrance in the back was high enough, but we already know that it's not. Even so, Governor Connally's certainty that the bullet that hit Kennedy didn't hit him somewhat would undercut that argument, as does Connally's late reaction on the Zapruder film, which was noted by Commissioners John McCloy and Alan Dulles. Another counterargument from Warren Report defenders is that Kennedy was leaning forward at the time of the shots, and that forward lean would make it so that the trajectory wouldn't have to be so pronounced. But the Zapruder film doesn't show Kennedy leaning forward that much. There's also an argument that we can't rely on Kennedy's clothing as evidence for the location of the wound because his suit was bunched up. Now, I looked at that claim, and it's true that there was some bunching with Kennedy's suit around the back of his neck, but not nearly enough to account for this discrepancy in the location of the wounds. Thus, like President Johnson, Senator Russell, and Governor Connally, I do not believe that the single bullet theory is correct. Issue number 12 from episode 16. Where did the shot that hit Kennedy's head originate from? My answer is that it probably came from the right front near the grassy knoll. But there may have been a second headshot from the back shortly after the first shot that was from the right front. The Warren Report says that Kennedy was hit at the base of his head and that his head was leaning forward at the time he was shot, such that the shot entered the lower right part of Kennedy's head and then exited out the top right side. Attorney General Ramsey Clark created a panel of doctors who then reviewed the autopsy materials and moved the location of the entry wound up by about 4 inches to Kennedy's cowlick area without changing anything about the exit wound. The HSCA adopted the Clark panel's higher position, one that no witnesses, including the autopsy doctors at Bethesda, ever observed. The official story is challenged by the documented accounts from witnesses at both Parkland Hospital and Bethesda Naval Center. Specifically, as many as 43 people, most of them doctors or nurses, saw a wound in the right rear of the president's head. This includes very credible testimony from Dr. McClelland, who was next to Kennedy's head and had the best view of all of the Parkland doctors. To further highlight that a lower rear head wound was seen, the cerebellar tissue was observed by 8 Parkland doctors, including Dr. Kemp Clark, the head of neurosurgery. If these doctors saw cerebellum, the wound had to be low enough in the back of the head for the cerebellum to be visible. And autopsy photographer John Stringer also said that the cerebellum was destroyed in the brain photos that he took. The testimony of the Parkland doctors and Stringer is opposed to what Dr. Humes and Dr. Boswell said, which is that there was no damage to the cerebellum at all. We also have several witnesses who say that they saw a small entrance wound near the president's temple. This includes Bethesda orderly Dennis David, Joe O'Donnell, who says that he was shown the photo by Robert Knudsen, and notably, the mortician who prepared Kennedy's body for burial, Tom Robinson. Now, this is not enough to prove that there was an entry wound in Kennedy's temple, but it's worth noting, given all of the other information that corroborates a shot from the right front. Then we have Harper's fragment, which is this disputed piece of bone that was found in the infield of Dealey Plaza the day after the assassination. The fragment was shown to the chief pathologist at Methodist Hospital in Dallas, who determined that it was occipital bone, which is the bone that's in the lower part of your skull. If so, that would prove that there was a rear head wound, because it would have been the rear head bone that was blown out. But this issue is disputed by experts. The HSCA found that the Harper fragment was actually parietal bone, which would be consistent with the Warren report. Today, the bone fragment has gone missing, but we do still have photos of it. Another consideration when it comes to Kennedy's head wound is that the autopsy photos of his body don't show any damage past his ear. Seibert and O'Neill both insisted that there was no damage past the president's ear. But using either the original autopsy location or the Clark panel location of the entry wound, we would expect to see an exit wound near Kennedy's face, or at least the right part of his forehead. But there was no exit wound there. Looking at the Zapruder film, the president's body goes violently back and to the left. It's also true that it looks like there's damage to the right side of Kennedy's head in the film. What we don't see is a large explosion of blood and brain going forward or backwards. The Zapruder film is not as conclusive for me as I hoped it would be. But it tends to show that Kennedy was hit from the front because his body went clearly back and to the left. Now, Larry Sturtevant's counterpoint about a last dying spasm causing Kennedy's movement back and to the left doesn't hold up under objective scrutiny, because Kennedy did not react in the same way that the goats reacted when Sturtevant shot them in the head. I leave open the possibility that Josiah Thompson's theory of a second headshot hitting the president from the rear 7/10 of a second after the first shot hit him from the right front is accurate. It could be possible. HSCA medical panel expert Dr. Michael Bodden said that while the possibility was remote, there could have been a headshot from the front, but only if there was another headshot from the back shortly after. And Dr. Bodden's timing for that possibility is precisely consistent with Josiah Thompson's theory. Now, I'm not certain about this by any means, but it is possible, it fits with the evidence, and it's worth considering. I conclude that the shot that hit President Kennedy's head likely originated from the right front. Now, the problem with this conclusion is that it's completely against the weight of the autopsy's photographic and x-ray evidence that was presented in the Warren report. That leads to the next issue. Issue number 13, from episodes 17 and 18. Is there any evidence of x-ray or photographic forgeries associated with President Kennedy's autopsy? Yes, it sounds crazy, but it appears that either the photographs and x-rays were altered, or there were two different autopsies, or a combination of both. I don't reach this conclusion lightly. So let's talk about the evidence that I'm relying on. Autopsy photographer John Stringer told the Assassination Records Review Board under oath that he did not recognize the brain photos in evidence because he never took photos with a view from underneath the brain. And, like the eight Parkland doctors, Stringer said that the cerebellum was damaged and cut in the photos that he remembered taking. But the official autopsy photos show the cerebellum being intact. Stringer also said that he used different film from what the photos were printed on, and that he put ID tags on the photos, which weren't present. It's true that Stringer did say that he wasn't sure about some things, so it's possible that he forgot. But for providing so much detail, I'm not just throwing out what he said, especially since it appears to be corroborated by other witnesses. Robert Knudsen told his family, who told the ARRB because Knudsen was not alive at the time, that he was the only photographer at the autopsy. Now, we know this isn't true because John Stringer was the official autopsy photographer. Knudsen told his family that in one of the photos, hair had been drawn in to cover a missing portion of the top back of the president's head. Sondra Spencer was a Navy warrant officer who processed the film from the autopsy. She told the ARRB that the photos in the record are not the ones that she remembered processing. Spencer also brought a copy of the paper that she used at the time with her to her ARRB interview, and that paper did not match the photo paper that was used in the autopsy photos in the record. Finally, Dr. David Mantic is the radiologist physicist who says that the X-ray and photos of the back of Kennedy's head are both forged. Mantic used an optical densitometer to determine the light coming back from Kennedy's skull on the X-ray. He found that the light is far too bright to be naturally occurring and indicates that a patch must have been used. He also used a stereo viewer on the photographs and determined that there was a patch added onto the photo that shows the rear of the president's head. So it looks like the photos in the archives are not the same as what the official photographer remembers or what the person who processed the photos remembers. And then we have another photographer who says that he took photos where no other photographer was present. This makes it possible that there were two separate sets of autopsies performed. One where Knudsen took photos and one where Stringer took photos. And I have yet to hear a technical refutation of Dr. Mantic. This evidence is even more compelling given that 43 witnesses say that they saw a right rear head wound, which is not reflected in the autopsy documents. For all of those reasons, I find that there is evidence of photographic and X-ray forgery. I don't know the details of what happened, but simply listening to the people who were involved is enough to show that something strange is going on with the photographs and the X-rays from the autopsy. Issue number 14 from episodes 21 through 24. Did Lee Harvey Oswald kill Officer J.D. Tippit? My answer is probably not, but the scenario where Oswald didn't shoot Tippit is a bit fantastical. There are four key facts that suggest that Oswald did kill Officer Tippit. First, Oswald had a revolver on him when he was arrested. This revolver is supposedly in the National Archives today and has the same serial number as the gun that the paperwork shows was ordered by A.J. Hedell. But there's no paperwork or witnesses to establish that Oswald actually picked up the revolver when it was ordered. But still, for Oswald to be innocent, the police or the FBI would have had to switch the revolver that Oswald had on him for the one that has the serial number on the paperwork. That's a big claim to make without any evidentiary support. Second, there are 9 eyewitnesses who identified Oswald as the man that they saw running with the gun. Most of these identifications were the product of a police lineup where Oswald had a black eye, was dressed differently from other people in the lineup, and where Oswald gave his name and place of employment. Still, the fact of 9 witnesses all identifying Oswald is a bad fact for Oswald that cannot be ignored. Third, the markings on the shells found at the scene were consistent with being fired from the revolver that Oswald was found with, according to the Warren Report. Remember how the shooter emptied the shells from his gun? Here is that evidence in the record. The question is, who was the shooter? Fourth, a light gray zip-up jacket was found in a parking lot between the Tippit shooting and the Texas Theater. Lee's wife, Marina, said that this was Lee's jacket, but there was also a dry cleaning tag on the jacket, and Marina said that Lee never dry cleaned anything. I count 8 facts that support Oswald's innocence in the Tippit murder. First, based on the time that the Warren report says Oswald left his rooming house, it wouldn't be possible for him to have been at the Tippit murder scene if you look at the witness testimony. The testimony of cab driver William Scoggins and Oswald's landlady Earlene Roberts puts Oswald leaving his rooming house around 1:05. It would take between 10 to 15 minutes to walk from Oswald's rooming house to the Tippit murder scene at 10th and Patton. When Tippit was shot, Margie Higgins, who lived close to the murder scene, looked at the clock on top of her TV and it said 1:06. Helen Markham said that the shooting was at 1:06 or 1:07 because she was on her way to catch her 1:12 bus a block north. T.F. Bowley encountered Tippett's wounded body on the ground and looked at his watch, and the time was 1:10. And Butch Burroughs says Oswald entered the Texas Theater between 1 and 1:07 and that he sold Oswald popcorn at 1:15. Putting all of this together, it's impossible that Oswald could have shot Tippit unless everyone's clocks are off and we completely disregard all evidence when it comes to time. The time evidence that we have puts the shooting between 1:06 and 1:10. It's not possible that Oswald could have traveled from his rooming house to the Tippit murder scene in just 5 minutes, especially if he was already at the Texas Theater, as Butch Burroughs says. Second, the shooter's actions are not consistent with someone who was on the run from law enforcement. Eyewitnesses like Helen Markham say that Tippit stopped his car, and then the shooter stopped walking, approached the car, and then put his arms inside the open window on the passenger side. This is the behavior of someone who knows the officer or, at a minimum, has no worries about being arrested. And it makes no sense unless Oswald was just completely crazy, which is what Warren Report defenders attribute this behavior to. Third, while the shells found at the crime scene were consistent with being fired from the revolver, the bullets from Tippett's body could not be traced back to the revolver. Fourth, Warren Reynolds did not initially identify Oswald and was then shot in the head, after which time he changed his position and said that he could identify Oswald. Now, Reynolds himself believed that the shooting was meant to send him a message, and he said that the reason he changed his testimony was because he wanted to live. This points to potential witness tampering, and it begs the question of why such witness tampering would be necessary. Fifth, Oswald is wearing a brown shirt when he's arrested, but none of the 9 witnesses from the crime scene said he was wearing a brown shirt. They all say he had a white t-shirt under the jacket. Now, an important caveat is that Johnny Brewer and Julia Postal do say that the man who entered the theater without buying a ticket was wearing a brown shirt. The 6th fact potentially supporting Oswald's innocence is the unbelievability of Johnny Brewer's story that he found out about the Tippit shooting on the radio and that he was on the lookout for the suspect. Given that the shooting was about 7 blocks away from Brewer's store and that there was a delay between when the shooting happened and when the police dispatch was notified, it's hard to believe that Brewer was telling the truth. Even if the delay was short, Brewer didn't have a police scanner, so how could he possibly know to be on the lookout in such a short period of time? But maybe Brewer was just exaggerating and this issue is a red herring. That is possible. 7. The fingerprints on Tippett's passenger window ledge where the shooter was seen to put his hands by Helen Markham did not match Oswald's fingerprints. Jack Tatum, who came forward years later, somewhat undermines this argument because he says that Oswald kept his hands in his jacket the whole time. But Tatum would have been farther away and driving the opposite direction when it happened, so it's possible that he didn't see the entire interaction or that he was mistaken. The eighth thing that aids Oswald defense is witness testimony that the shooter had a ruddy skin complexion. This was said by Ted Calloway, Domingo Benavides, Helen Markham, and Julia Postal. Now, Oswald did not have a red skin complexion. When this fact is combined with statements of Butch Burroughs and Bernard Hare that someone who looked just like Oswald was taken out of the back of the Texas theater by police when we know that Oswald was taken out the front, it starts to look like there's another guy who looks like Oswald but has a more ruddy skin tone. We also have the insane story about the man who looked like Oswald sitting in a car near the Texas theater after Oswald had already been arrested. The license plate of this car came back as belonging to a military contractor who was a very close friend of Officer Tippett, Carl Mather. Mather insisted on immunity to merely speak to the HSCA, which makes this incident even more salacious and mysterious. In addition to these 8 points in Oswald's defense, we have Earlene Roberts' testimony under oath about a honking police car that happened to stop in front of the house and honk during this 2 or 3 minutes when Oswald was at the rooming house. We also have the saga of the competing Oswald wallets with both Oswald and Hedel IDs inside. The source of the wallet at the National Archives is in dispute. FBI agent Bob Barrett says that Captain Westbrook found the wallet at the Tippett crime scene, but Sergeant Gerald Hill and Detective Paul Bentley both say that Oswald had the wallet on him while he was in the police car after being arrested at the Texas Theater. Finally, we have the bizarre actions of Officer Tippett immediately before he was killed that make it clear that he was frantically looking for someone in particular. Maybe it was Oswald. But if it was, then Tippett would have to already personally know Oswald, or at least know what he looked like, given how vague the description was of the man who was fleeing, an average-looking thin white guy in his 20s. I'm not sure exactly what happened in the murder of Officer Tippett, but I can't write off the times that were given by all of the witnesses. I agree that there would be a range and that everyone's watches were not synchronized in 1963 the way that everyone's phones and digital watches are synchronized today. But even with that range, the timing evidence seems to exonerate Oswald. This issue leans towards Oswald not being the shooter. But for that to be true, it requires an Oswald lookalike, faked revolver order documents, and a switcheroo of Oswald's revolver for the one used in the crime, which was ordered to the Hedel P.O. box. Issue 15 from episode 26. Why did Jack Ruby kill Oswald? The quick answer is to make sure that Oswald couldn't defend himself or share anything that he may have known. We have Jack Ruby sightings all over the place on November 22nd, including in Dealey Plaza, at Parkland Hospital, and even at the Texas Theater. But it's the Ruby sightings once Oswald is in police custody that are the most interesting. Ruby tried to enter the area where Oswald was being held on the third floor of the police department early in the evening. Then, later that night, Ruby chimed in on Oswald's affiliation with Fair Play for Cuba at a press conference. Why was Ruby at the police station during all of these times? We know that Ruby liked to be in the mix of what was going on and was generally a curious person. We also know that he was very friendly with the Dallas police. So Ruby being at the police station at the same time as the accused assassin of the president doesn't necessarily prove anything. Now, Ruby's alibi as to why the murder wasn't premeditated is that he had just sent a money transfer minutes before at the nearby Western Union, And if he cared about killing Oswald, he wouldn't have missed his chance by sending this money transfer. But there are two facts that suggest that Ruby decided in advance to kill Oswald. First, the Karen Carlin wire transfer shows that Ruby planned with Carlin in advance that he would send her a wire transfer. Given that the record shows that Carlin was not in need of the money since she was about to receive her regular paycheck the following day, and that Ruby is the one who had the idea to send her the funds via Western Union, it appears that Ruby was trying to use this as a proactive alibi against premeditation. Remember, Western Union was only 350 feet away from the police department. Second, there were three live TV technicians, all of whom claimed that they saw Ruby on multiple occasions between 8 a.m. and 11 a.m. on the day he shot Oswald near the police building. Ruby was supposed to be at home during those times. The Warren Report ignored the testimony of these three TV techs, but to me, their shared recollection is one more reason to show that Ruby's actions were premeditated. He's hanging around the building at a time when he said he wasn't there. Doesn't look good. The best argument against Ruby planning out the murder of Oswald is that Ruby left his dog in the car. But then again, Ruby could have done that in a cold and calculated way to make it appear that he was just acting randomly, just like how he arranged the Western Union transfer. When we look at Ruby's actions and statements after he killed Oswald, it becomes obvious that his motive was to silence Oswald. In support of this conclusion, we have Detective Don Archer, who was with Ruby when he learned that Oswald died. Archer says that Ruby's reaction wasn't concern about being subject to the death penalty, it was relief. The notes from Ruby's psychiatrist, who did say that Ruby was insane, said that Ruby had said the Kennedy assassination was, quote, an act of overthrowing the government. Ruby also told his psychiatrist that, quote, I was framed to kill Oswald. You can take or leave what Deputy Sheriff Al Maddox says about Ruby passing him a note that says that Ruby was part of a larger conspiracy and the purpose of killing Oswald was to silence him. We don't have the note, and Maddox's statement was years later. But the video of Jack Ruby plainly stating in front of his lawyers and the press that the world will never know what really happened because powerful people are silencing him is the showstopper. In my view, this is a straight-up confession. The only way you could believe that Ruby's murder of Oswald was not premeditated to silence him is if you are thoroughly convinced of the idea that Ruby was crazy and you hang your hat on what his psychiatrist said. But if you listen to the audio with Ruby's own words, he doesn't sound crazy to me. So there you have it. About half of my conclusions were inconclusive and left the door open. But the other half are solidly in the Warren Report critic camp. These findings are that Oswald was not in place on the sixth floor when the shots were fired. Someone impersonated a Secret Service agent on the grassy knoll. CE-399 is not the single bullet. The single bullet theory is not possible. Kennedy's headshot came from the right front. And that Jack Ruby's motive for killing Oswald was to silence him. I have enough evidence compiled to confidently say that the Warren Report did not get it right. But we have a long way to go before we solve anything. The implication of these conclusions are that we need to find more information about the Secret Service imposter, the ruddy-complected man who looked like Oswald, the driver of the Green Rambler, and the dark-complected man who sat near Umbrella Man. Another massive question that we haven't looked at yet is who was Lee Harvey Oswald really? I mean, why would he go to the Texas Theater for a matinee movie right after the president was killed? If he was really innocent, Wouldn't he have stuck around to be questioned and then go home to his family? While I don't think Oswald fired the shots that killed Kennedy, I can't say that Oswald is innocent, given all of his strange behavior. Actually, we've got a lot more work to do when it comes to Oswald. Next season on Solving JFK, we'll zoom in to the life and times of Lee Harvey Oswald. What was it like for him growing up? What about his time in the Marines? Why did he defect to the USSR at the height of the Cold War? Who was Oswald hanging out with in New Orleans and Dallas? What about the General Walker shooting and the backyard photo allegedly showing Oswald with the rifle and the revolver? What more can we learn about Ruth Payne and George de Morenschild? Is there any evidence to support Oswald being an intelligence asset? And is there any support for this idea of an Oswald lookalike? If you heard anything on this episode that lacks context or you think is incorrect, please let us know. You can email solvingjfkpodcast@gmail.com. Please provide a citation and we'll consider it for a future rebuttal episode.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
Thanks for listening. Visit solvingjfkpodcast.com for more information.